This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hello, I'm Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear surgeon and I practice with ENT and Allergy Associates in New York City and New Jersey.
And I'm Marina Kurian. I'm a general and minimally invasive surgeon in New York City. And today's show is about humanitarianism. We have some great guests that Sujana is going to introduce.
So we are very fortunate today to welcome a urogynecology surgeon, Dr. Sue Kwan, who's at Lenox Hill Hospital, and she is the part of a global organization that provides urogynecological care overseas. And Dr. Girma Tefera, who is a vascular surgeon at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and he is part of the American College of Surgeons Operation Giving Back. So today we're going to talk about their surgical endeavors, their experiences, and global and humanitarian outreach.
Absolutely. But first, Suju and I are going to run through some of the news. We lost Justice Ginsburg, or the notorious RBG, as we all like to refer to her. I happened to just open my phone and it popped up immediately. And I think my heart stopped. And I was with friends at dinner and they were like, what's the matter? I was like, RBG just died. And I think this is a sentiment that so many people, not just in the US, but globally have experienced. I mean, she was such a tireless fighter for equity and equality, which are not exactly the same thing. So I think, this is a big loss for us as a nation, and certainly will be interesting in the Supreme Court as well.
Yeah, she was, as you said, a tireless fighter for proper rights for our country living up to its promise. She also fought an incredible fight against pancreatic cancer. She, if you know her story or if you don't know her story, check it out because it's an amazing story of resilience and perseverance. Chief Justice John Roberts said, "Our nation has lost a jurist of historic stature. Today we mourn, but with confidence that future generations will remember Ruth Bader Ginsburg as we knew her, a tireless and resolute champion of justice." I think we've learned a great deal from her. We've lost something, and hopefully we can go forward in her spirit. Wanted to just show you this picture of what used to be the four female justices on the Supreme Court. Now there are three. And one of my absolutely favorite quotes by RBG, one that speaks to the way I pursue my life, really. She said, "When I'm asked, when will there be enough women on the Supreme Court? Well, I say, when there are nine. People are shocked, but there had been nine men and nobody's ever raised a question about that." And I think that just speaks to everything about her spirit.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have some images at the end of the show as well about Ruth Bader, but we should be also talking about what's happening in the world. And unfortunately, we still are going to talk about COVID. I just can't wait for the day for our show that will be like, oh, and then that we'll probably still mention it, but in passing is, guess what? Now there's a vaccine or whatever. So we have a lot to talk about. The first slide that we're going to look at is a graph of what's happening in Europe. And you'll see that in some of the countries, there's an uptick in like mid-June through current. And that Spain, France are much higher than UK and Italy. And it's something that everybody's watching and trying to see what's going to happen, something that we worry about here that we're going to have a second wave. And thankfully, so far in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, we're not seeing that second wave as they are in Europe. But we were like how many weeks behind Europe when they were really going through it. We started, our first case in New York was March 1st. So we're a few weeks behind. And so we're just carefully watching.
So our executive producer, Sri Srinivasan, is watching from a park. We have graciously, very graciously, Marina, I feel, given him the day off so he could actually reconnect with his family. You know, COVID deaths in the United States, unfortunately, hit the 200,000 mark yesterday, I believe. Deaths in Europe are over 225,000. This is not a fake disease. We are seeing young people. One of my colleagues reported a 21-year-old young man coming in with a heart attack because of COVID. The medical community just lost a young woman, 28-year-old OBGYN resident, to COVID. She unfortunately passed away Friday or Saturday. So this is a real disease. So, you know, everyone's talking about vaccines. So normally it takes a really long time to get a vaccine or anything that you inject into the body approved by the Food and Drug Administration. So we have a slide that kind of shows you that the normal process takes several years to get a vaccine from its idea, animal studies, initial safety studies, all the way to safety and efficacy studies, and then approval and into market. What we are trying to do is we are trying to expedite this process. And there are many groups and countries working furiously to fast track the vaccine. So Marina, maybe you can talk to us about the next graphic from Business Insider, looking at the vaccine development.
Sure. So, you know, one thing I want to say about that last slide, though, is that if you just look at the minimum numbers, like 3 years, 2 years, and then 1 year, you're still talking about a 6-year process, which is what, when people started talking about the vaccine, a lot of scientists, doctors, even lay people were like, well, hang on a second, you're going to produce a vaccine in a year. So if we go to the next slide, you'll see that there are several companies that are already into phase three, which is really fantastic. And the prediction was that by the fall, and the group working out of Oxford, working with AstraZeneca, had said that they should probably have something available in October, which is literally around the corner. And Moderna is there too. And so AstraZeneca had, and Oxford had halted their trial because they had one patient have an adverse event, something that they were trying to evaluate and see if it was related to the vaccine. And that's very common in any clinical study, that you stop and you assess and you look for underlying cause or whether it was related to the vaccine itself. And so that trial actually resumed. So all the trials are kind of cooking along. And we think, who is the one of the heads of, I think the CDC, was it? Or NIH, head of the NIH? Said that we're going to probably won't see these vaccines till second or third quarter.
Yeah, it was the CDC. It was Robert Redfield from the CDC said we may see some initial vaccinations in December, but we really are not going to see it rolled out until probably the third, maybe the second quarter of 2021. And even he pointed out that really the best line of defense remains the three W's: wear a mask, wash your hands, watch your distance from others. Dr. Francis Collins, who's the head of the NIH and very famously introduced the word MANL into medical community. A MANL is a men-only panel. And a couple of years back, Dr. Collins announced that he would no longer speak at a conference or on a panel where there was not representation of women, which I think is amazing. But Dr. Collins announced that one of the NIH-funded studies that's being done at the University of Washington has developed proteins that can block SARS-CoV-2, which is the SARS coronavirus 2, which is the causative virus for COVID, from infecting cell receptors in the nose. So this could be sort of like that pre-COG or pre-treatment in the future. So this is also a very exciting way to deliver potential immunity in the future. So yeah, we're looking at lots of interesting science being developed rather quickly.
What I think is so funny is because you're ENT and you're like, don't put anything in the ear and don't put anything up the nose. Now you're like, oh my God, this is so cool. Proteins.
Yeah, shove some proteins up there.
And you're going to be protected. I'm thinking that's a good thing. Let's do it. We also have, this is Women in Medicine Month. I would just like it to be Women in Medicine every day, by the way. And certainly for us it is, and hopefully for our colleagues. But for this month, we just have a slide, a graphic showing all of our fantastic guests that we've had since we started the show. There have been 22 fantastic doctors and leaders in other fields that we've had, as well as Dr. Su Kwan, who's going to come on today.
So we are, if you've missed any of our shows, you can find us on our YouTube channel. And I love going back and watching them, actually. And please, we are live on all social media channels. So please like us and follow us and tag your friends who might be interested. We have two fantastic guests, as we mentioned at the top of the hour. We have Dr. Su Kwan, who is the chief of urogynecology at Lenox Hill Hospital of the Northwell Health System in New York City. She's vice president of FIUGA, which is the Federation for International Urogynecological Assistance. And we have Dr. Guillermo Tefera, who is chief of vascular surgery at the University of Wisconsin Medical Center in Madison, Wisconsin, and medical director of Operation Giving Back for the American College of Surgeons. So welcome to the show, Guillermo and Su.
Thank you.
Oh, there you are. We got you.
We just got flashes. Flashes of brilliance. It's all good, though.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for having me and for the introduction. So
we're happy to have you, Su. We're happy to have you, Guillermo. Maybe we'll just start by saying, how are things going? How's life, Su?
Well, I think I have to truly agree with everything that you have described about both COVID and the death of Ruth. And I have to tell you that I never knew that my kids, who are in their 20s going to college and medical school, knew how much I admired her over the years, actually texted me, and they are the ones who alerted me that she passed away. And they were tremendously sad for the society and for what I felt. And they're still sending me texts in saying that world will go on, you'll be okay.
Oh, it's so nice when our children get to the age when they can comfort us, right?
Yes.
How about you, Guillermo? How are things going with you?
Well, you know, life is different in COVID era with all the restrictions, as you can imagine. And I think 2021 has been quite the year, and clearly the highlight of your news, you know, sums it up even more, bring some additional reality that we are going to be facing probably for the next several months. And so, you know, to say the least, I think it has been a difficult year, but we'll get through it.
You know, I'm looking at the data from Wisconsin, and our positivity rate in New York, New Jersey is below 1% and has stayed there. But the positivity rate in Wisconsin is high and is going, seems to be more cases now that schools are opening, lots of young people contracting the disease. Are you seeing that at your hospital?
Well, you know, the hospitals are still relatively okay, not overwhelmed, but it definitely had something to do with the university's opening. As you can imagine, a campus like Madison has over 40,000 students. And so it was not a small plan to get that going, and clearly these 2 week gaps, you know, since the opening, has definitely contributed to that. And there has been also, as most of other places, you know, people who have not been sold on the idea of the three W's you are mentioning as well. That's not helping either.
So is there a mask mandate in Wisconsin?
Well, kind of, but it's not reinforced. It's not, you know, and so the governor is definitely has that in place, but I don't think you are being chased or made responsible or so there is no control. I think that's part of the problem.
Sue, tell us a lot about what you do. You're a gynecologist. What does that mean? What's so interesting is that Sue and I kind of work together at one hospital, but Sujana is actually the one who invited you, and you guys have a whole back history. I didn't even know about it. I'm like, what? I thought she was my friend, but apparently not. So anyway, either way, we have you here because you guys are both such great humanitarians and do wonderful work, but you are also an expert in your field, and we definitely want to know, what is your gynecology? Who needs you?
Well, first of all, I'm more than happy to be shared by both fabulous surgeons. So that's number one. Number two is I really appreciate having a platform to discuss what I feel very passionately. And it's a field where so little number of people and women and doctors know about. And so just like what Marina said, when patients come in to see me, they've already seen 3, 4, 5 different doctors for the same problem because people are unaware of what I do. And so this is a fairly new specialty that deals with female pelvic floor health. What that means is that women who have problems with, let's say, urinary incontinence, leaking urine, or vagina prolapsing out, and bladder pain, fecal incontinence, as in their leaking stool, anything that has to do with female pelvic floor. And so in the past, people used to believe that they should go and see a colorectal surgeon or urologist, but they often didn't concentrate on female anatomy. And so patients did not receive the comprehensive care that they deserved because so much of it is connected when 80% of women who have incontinence have prolapse, meaning the vagina coming down, then I think it's really important, our society obviously does, that we look at the whole pelvic floor so that we can treat women as a whole. And that's what female pelvic floor health is, and medicine and reconstructive surgery.
You know, so we talk a lot about like osteoporosis in women. We talk about breast cancer in women. We talk about things that we consider women's diseases. Where does urinary incontinence fall in this spectrum? And also, if we forgot to do our Kegel exercises after our 4 pregnancies, are we fated to meet you?
Well, number one is it is very, very common. More than 50% of the women in their lifetime after the age of 50 will have some form of female pelvic issues. However, 80% of them will never share that information with their doctors without being asked. And so when doctors do not understand that, then patients obviously will not volunteer it. So that's number one. And number two is Kegel exercises. So when you do exercises, like when you do biceps exercises or any other exercises that you can see the muscles, you know what you're doing. Whereas when you're doing Kegel exercises, you will not be able to see your pelvic floor muscles contracting. And so most women, when they do Kegel exercises, really don't do them correctly. And when you don't do them correctly, you're more likely going to have harmful effect than positive effect. And so they are going to need much guidance for that to be effective. That's number one. And number two is what we are finding is that Kegel exercises often are not effective. And we are also very surprised as we are seeing prospective randomized trials in women in Europe. And so it really is based on how severe your problem is and how committed you are in doing Kegel exercises that can result in positive outcome. But even if you did everything right, you may not see a positive outcome.
So we have, I want to show a graph just showing how common the incontinence is. And you actually said, did you say 80% of women over 50, or did you say 50% of women over 50 are going to have the incontinence? But we also have a question from our audience. So let's talk about the incontinence first. And then the question was about interstitial cystitis.
Okay. And so more than 50% of women over the age of 50 will have pelvic floor issues that I have just mentioned. But let's say that you have one problem, such as incontinence, then 80% of the women will also have other pelvic floor problems, such as prolapse. So they often go together.
And is multiple pregnancies the risk? Like Suju said, you know, four, I've had two, some people only have one, or is it have something to do with your innate like collagen and elasticity of tissue?
Marina, that's a great question. It's multifactorial. So I would have nuns who would come into my office and they would have prolapse and incontinence, and then I'll have patients that or women who I would talk to who had eight kids and they have no problems. So that obviously shows that this is not just one risk factor, but it could be from having kids, which is one of the major risk factors, aging, childbirth, going through menopause, heavy lifting, type of job that you do. It could be genetics, race. So white race is much more likely to have problems with prolapse than black race, and diabetes, obesity, as we are talking about COVID, and I can go on and on. And so many women who would come in would think, oh yeah, it's because I had four kids, which is not necessarily the only risk factor. It's one of so many.
And then one of our Nirja asked about interstitial cystitis. Can you tell us what that is and what can be done about it?
So interstitial cystitis is one of those diseases that is in a, it's a diagnosis of exclusion. And so meaning that women will come in and say, I have recurrent UTIs because they have symptoms of UTI, such as frequency, urgency, burning on urination, pelvic discomfort, so on and so forth. And often, especially young women, will be treated with antibiotics without the cultures. And it comes pretty frequently. Even with antibiotics, they're still having discomfort. And so without the culture that's positive, without an obvious etiology of why they're having that pain, then we put them in a basket that's called interstitial cystitis. And so it's inflammation of the bladder wall.
All right, you guys, we are live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, and scroll in, and you guys can like, share, tweet, and tag your friends if you think that this is a show that are, you know, they would be interested in. We would love to have them join our conversation. Guillermo, can we talk about what you do? You're a vascular surgeon. Little known fact, very few people know this. I was almost a vascular surgeon, but we went a different route. And we's the royal we, it was me, myself, and I. But I loved, like, some of the things that you do. I love Gore-Tex. I love the feel of the graft. It was my favorite thing. I loved that graft, you know? So when we're doing open surgery and not endovascular, I was seriously thinking about it for a little while. So just let's talk about vascular surgery, how you got to where you, how you made the decision to do this. And then we're going to go through some slides of some common things that you might address.
Yeah, no, absolutely. First of all, thank you, Sujina and Marina, for inviting me to be on your show. and to talk about, you know, this vascular surgery, as well as hopefully about volunteerism. And, you know, from vascular surgery perspective, what got me was actually the time I was selecting and choosing to become a vascular specialist. Vascular surgery was going through some transformational times. And that was from the maximally invasive open procedures to the minimally invasive endovascular procedures. And so that is really what excited me. And it was late in 1990, where you could see through a small hole, big problems in the vessels being opened up. And that technology really is what got me into this specialty. And as you know, it's a very common problem, particularly in the developing countries, and so in the developed countries, but also in the developing countries. And in fact, it's now, you know, affects over 200 million people across the globe when you talk about vascular problems. So it is definitely a problem that can be considered number one killer because of heart disease, as you know, but it leads to so many complications that makes life difficult, be it losing legs or having a stroke. And when you look at this image here, which is one of the common things we do, it's basically identifying a blockage and then trying to do some procedure around it by way of bypassing that blockage, just rerouting the blood flow, if you will. But this might be necessary to save a leg. And this kind of blockage can also be treated by catheters and balloons and stents without the big open procedure these days. And so,
Can I ask you, what symptoms would the patient present with? So when, you know, we have big words, right? Intermittent claudication, which sounds kind of awesome, but what are the symptoms that patients are coming in with that they should maybe talk to their doctor about if there's any concern about this?
Yeah. So whenever you have blockages in any part of the blood vessels in the body, in the legs, for example, it may manifest itself with pain, with activity. So walking might be difficult. Walking uphill might be difficult. Walking not only is difficult, but at times the pain in the foot may wake you up at night. Or people may have sores in their feet and the legs that are not healing because there is no blood flow going to the leg. And sometimes a blockage, say, in the carotid artery in the neck may give you signs of what we call mini strokes, where sometimes loss of function of the arm or the leg may happen. Or sometimes people may have difficulty in speaking and finding words, particularly when the issue is on the left side. So that can give you an idea and a clue that the carotid artery might be the source of the problem. There is another disease called the aortic aneurysm, which is basically a huge bulge in the aorta that is actually, for most patients, asymptomatic, so meaning there is no symptom. Until it ruptures and it's found by accident. So it's important if there is a family history, some screening with ultrasound should be done, or for patients above age 65 and exhibit some risk factors like hypertension, blood pressure problems, and have been smokers, they need to be screened. So those are the kind of things to look for.
Guillermo, a lot of what you do is based off of finding the first symptoms, but for the aneurysm, though, as you said, they're asymptomatic, and you know, physical exam, if it's a big one, you might be able to find it. But you also use diagnostic modalities like ultrasound to kind of help identify. Like there's a special form of ultrasound, right, that you use to check the vessels in the neck, certainly for the carotid, to assess how much blockage there is. So can we just talk about how would someone find out that they have these issues? And also, just when you mentioned abdominal aneurysm, a colleague of ours, right, Dr. Franklin Morris, he passed of a ruptured aneurysm. It was completely unexpected.
Yeah. So I think the carotid piece, for example, or the blockage in the legs, usually during the annual visits, it's important for your physician to listen with a stethoscope over the vessels, and particularly the carotid vessels, to see if there is any turbulence in the blood flow. That will lead to a test called duplex, carotid duplex ultrasound. And it's very readily available, easy to do, and that can screen without any problems patients who may have significant blockage. In terms of the aorta, it's also a Doppler ultrasound of the aorta, and there is already a specific criteria who should be screened that the primary care physicians know about, and particularly this is written actually as part of one of the screening tests you should have when you are at age 65 and enroll into Medicare. And it is also done promptly and can rule out the presence of an aneurysm in the abdomen.
You know, when I was a resident in general surgery a million years ago at Bellevue, we had a patient come up with a huge abdominal aortic aneurysm. The nurse practitioner in the primary care clinic had just done a really good exam, and she had picked this up and sent it up. And when they can be picked up like that, we don't have the rupture, we don't have the catastrophe. And even back then in the dark ages, the patient did really well. I want to ask, one of our viewers has, we have viewers, by the way, from all over the world. We have people checking in from Bangalore. We have people checking in from Eastern Europe. We have people checking in from all over the United States. Danny Chelius said, you know, when he was a medical student, we really didn't learn almost anything about urogynecology. And Dr. Chandrasekhar, who is my mother, asked, what about bike riding and pelvic floor? Maybe Sue, you can answer that.
I'm not really sure what the question is.
So can, if you're bike riding, does that build up your pelvic floor muscles? Does that hurt or help, or doesn't do anything to what's going on with your pelvic floor?
I don't really think that there is much of an effect when you're bike riding. I don't know of any study that looked at women who ride their bike to help with the pelvic floor. I think that you should do it if that's what you enjoy. So I really have no opinion on that.
Let's talk. Oh, and this is the comment from Danny Chelius that, so if you concede, so I know that's much approved at my medical school in terms of urogyn issues. Do you think it's getting better when you speak with colleagues around the country? I mean, I think your colleagues are fairly familiar with what you do. It's so important. And certainly as we all get older, especially the women.
Well, I think that this is an evolution. And so this is a fairly new field. I've been doing this for 20 years. So 20 years ago, no one really knew what urogynecology was. At this point, I think that there are enough doctors who deal with abdomen down, who know somewhat of urogynecology, but still there are others who are not quite sure what we do.
So, you know, you had sent us some really good information. We showed the slide about urge incontinence, and maybe we can talk a bit about stress incontinence, and then we can talk about pessaries and non-surgical maneuvers. Maybe Sue, you can talk to us a little bit about how you assess these patients and what are the first line treatments.
Okay, so when a patient comes in, they feel that when they have incontinence, that the treatments are really the same and that it's like going to see an ophthalmologist. They'll say, I can't see. And they, you know, they don't realize that it could be from many different reasons and there are different types. It's the same thing with the bladder, that leaking urine is not all the same. They have different diagnoses and the treatments are different. And so when women leak urine with urgency, meaning that as they are trying to open the door and they've already started leaking and all they had to do was wait another 5 seconds and they can't control it and they don't quite understand, that's called urgency incontinence. And those women are treated with medications. And if they fail medications, then we can go to the next level, which would be either Botox or InterStim. And Botox works fabulously. And when I watch advertisements where they advertise diapers, female diapers, or pads, I get so irritated because it's so easy to treat the problem, the underlying problem, rather than using a diaper. And so that's something that I have to emphasize. And thank you for giving me that forum. Stress urinary incontinence, we always knew about, which is leaking urine with coughing, laughing, with exercises. When you stress, it means not stress to your head, like you're having a bad day, but when you're stressing your bladder, which is increasing the abdominal pressure, that's when you leak urine. So women they may not want to exercise because every time they jump, they leak urine. And they're always afraid that someone else can see that they're leaking urine. And that's stress urinary incontinence. And unlike what used to be 20 years ago, we can treat stress urinary incontinence both surgically and non-surgically. But surgery used to be such an invasive procedure for women for treatment of stress urinary incontinence. Now it takes less than 20 minutes and then they go home. And it is 80 to 90% successful. And so there are so many ways to treat women with these problems that there is really no reason for women to walk around wearing 5 to 10 pads or diapers a day.
That is the PSA right there. So if you're walking around heavily invested in feminine hygiene products for urine, please talk to your physician about getting a urogynecology referral so that maybe you can get this taken care of and go back to enjoying a full and active life.
Did you say with Botox, Sue?
Yes, I talked about Botox.
Yeah. I did. That Botox goes everywhere.
It cures it all.
We can do that in the office. We can do that in an outpatient setting with a little sedation, and it lasts for close to a year. And patient satisfaction rate is really extremely high.
We want to talk about, there are other devices, though. You mentioned about the diapers and the pads and things like that. But there's also
pessaries.
Yeah. Yep, and we have quite the collection here. They look kind of scary.
Yeah, that's what they are, right? I have to tell you that pessaries have been around for thousands of years, and it's not anything that is recent. And when you look at the historical background, that there are some eras where women had worn potatoes in their vagina. And the potatoes would grow the roots so that that would elevate the vagina. But anyway, for 2020, let's talk about the pessaries that are available. And there are so many different types and shapes and sizes. And pessaries are not painful as long as you have the right type of pessary. Not every patient will have the pessary that will fit them correctly. And so if you have the right type of pessary, that works very well for most women. However, the downside is it's not a cure, it's a treatment. So once the pessary is out for many different reasons, you want that out because you really don't like the discharge or the side effects of spotting, bleeding, then everything goes back to the way it was. So it's definitely not a cure.
So we're going to go back to Girma for a second. We had a question come up from Chris Ramanathan. Are untreated varicose veins dangerous? So can you talk to us about what is a varicose vein and when do you need treatment and what kind of treatments there are for it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you for that question. So varicose veins are basically veins that are abnormally enlarged, and you see them in the legs. They are usually easily visible, and they are caused because there is some increased pressure in them. And the way I usually describe this to make it clearer is veins are usually pipes that take blood to the heart, and they have a one-way valve. And that one-way valve gets abnormal. And so when that happens, it can leak backwards. And it leaks backwards, meaning towards the feet rather than going the blood going toward the heart. So what that does is then leads to enlargement of this pipe wherever this leak is happening. And because either we sit or we stand up, gravity pulls more and more of this blood down. And so these veins get larger and larger. So what happens is, you know, at the end of the day, the legs get fatigued, the legs get painful. Sometimes actually it can cause some skin changes that can go as far as becoming an ulcer. And when that ulcer happens, unless you take care of the vein, it will be very hard to keep the ulcers heal and maintain the healing. So like anything else in medicine, and in surgery, varicose vein treatment has also gone through a transformational phase where currently there are a lot of minimally invasive ways of treating this using laser, using some catheters that have heat probes, and also using some injections of medication that can cause these veins to collapse and occlude themselves. If patients have large veins, but they don't have any symptoms or they have no pain and there is no ulcer, most of them can be treated with compression socks. And these compression socks, what they do is basically support the veins to carry the blood away from the feet towards the heart. And so surgery is not always necessary. But if there are complications like ulcers in the feet, if pain is an issue, someone who's up in their feet for hours and hours a day and they are really miserable from this, you know, those are the situations where we use this combination of minimally invasive and sometimes some small microphlebectomy, we call it. It can be office procedure as well. Yes.
I have a question for you. We don't always have all surgeons on, but we all have, happen to be all four surgeons. Who wears compression socks in the OR?
Right.
I mean, I'm going to call you out first. Do you wear them?
I do.
You do? Oh, you're so good. Okay.
I do wear compression socks almost every day.
That's wonderful. Okay, I'm calling you the other two out too. I don't wear them because I just forget to bring them. But of course, and I do have some varicose veins actually that I've had injected. So this is bad. I should be wearing them.
So Sue, do you wear them? I can't remember. I saw you half naked in the locker room, but I can't remember.
Not yet.
You know, so I don't wear them because it's just yet another thing. And lots of my surgeries are sitting, not that that diminishes varicose veins, but I often wear my husband's socks in the OR because they're nice and snug. And if I'm going to get blood on socks, I might as well get them on his socks.
Wow. That is so mean. But the compression socks, I have colleagues who've been wearing them since they were residents, you know, and it's just, and I actually looked at some of them and I'm like, dude, I think those are from when you were a resident. Yeah. You know, if they're my contemporaries, it's a long time. But I think it is so important to wear compression stockings. Certainly sometimes on a long flight, like if I'm going, you know, abroad or going to California from East Coast, I'll pop those on because otherwise I've got cankles. It's, you know, no good.
And what about doing exercises on those long flights where you do this sort of ankle stretch? Does that help, Girma?
Yeah, you know, I think those are all important maneuvers you do to protect yourself from getting blood clots in the veins, right? So that you can pump the muscles and the muscles contract and push the blood out of the way, if you will, from the veins. And the compression socks, I think, are really, you know, a challenge when you have to wear them high thigh because they roll down. And a lot of people, because of that, become a little bit non-compliant, if you will. But I think the below the knee ones are usually well, you know, used, and pumping the feet in during long flights really are helpful for those who are affected by blood clot disorders. And it's important to actually get up and be walking around rather than only pumping the calf muscles for that matter.
So we have viewers checking in from Bangalore, India, from Cardiff by the Sea, which is in California, from, as I said, all over. And they're really interested in what both of you have to say. We're going to switch gears a little bit. We mentioned that it's Women in Medicine Month. And I have to say, Girma, this is a slide of two pictures that you sent me. When I was president of the American Academy of Otolaryngology, I got to go on stage at the American College of Surgeons annual meeting, and I took my daughter with me on that trip. And you had never met her, but you saw this little girl stand up in the audience and take a picture. And you took a picture of her and sent it to me and said, I think this is your daughter. And it is one of the most precious memories I have from that. And I think you really embody that he for she concept. Can you tell us about the women in the slide that you had there?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, this is really a very important thing for me in terms of, you know, from my upbringing, from Africa, and we have a single mom that actually carried 7 children, if you will, to success. You know, when it comes to surgery, there is, you know, 0.5 surgeon per 100,000. And of those, particularly in the eastern part, 93% are men. And so one of the priorities that we have set together with the College of Surgeons in that area is, with the American College of Surgeons, is to support women to be surgeons and to support them to be surgeons. Because if we leave behind 50% of the population, guess what? The needs are never going to be fulfilled. And it is just an opportunity for us to actually do what is right. And we have been really been successful so far in supporting about 37 female women residents in that area to complete their examination. And we provide them with some resources too.
This is
since 2017, and we want to get to 1,000 of them. So I really do think this is something that people should know and support and celebrate with us.
And I'm sure that you do this here in your program here. I was always very lucky to have very egalitarian professors and teachers in surgery, so I never felt that I was being held back at all. If anything, I was always encouraged, or at least that's how I interpreted it, that they weren't trying to hold me back. But Sue, I want to talk to you about some of your humanitarian work because, you know, first of all, leaving the country, going somewhere else and helping others, but really teaching others, that's what both of you are actually doing, which is so much more important than just going and doing a surgery and coming back home. So let's talk about some of your efforts and the society that you're now a vice president of.
So I have to start from the beginning, and I'll try to make it really quick. When I started 15 years ago, we truly believed that if we can help even one individual to lead a semi-normal life, that was a good thing. And so in female pelvic floor health, one of the major issues in Africa, not so much just the developing countries, but in Africa, is fistula. Fistula is a hole that is developed between vagina to, let's say, to rectum or bladder, where women are defecating or voiding, peeing through the vagina. So they have no control, mostly from pregnancy and delivery. And so we don't know the exact number, but we believe there are over 2 million women in the world who suffer from fistula that have not been repaired or are waiting. And most women don't even know that this could be fixed. So that's what I got started with. I was invited to start this little project by an organization 15 years ago. And a bunch of us, 20 of us would go and we would repair 100, 200 fistulas in a 2-week period. Then I got involved with International Urogyn Association, which is the largest urogyn association in the world. And during that time, we decided that we need to actually find a way to teach other doctors to do that work. We shouldn't be giving them fish, but we should be teaching them how to fish. And that's when it got started. And so in Africa, that there at that time, 7 years ago, there was no Urogyn fellowship training. So we decided that we are gonna actually venture into that. And I had no idea how I was gonna do this with our organization. And it was a struggle, but we were able to convince doctors and dean and other top politicians in Ghana to get involved with us to teach doctors to deal with female pelvic floor health. And so since then, we have trained seven surgeons to be urogynecologists. And we have a full program and we support them financially. And we have companies that support them for equipment and supplies. Then we decided that they really are doing well enough. And so initially we went 2 weeks out of every month and we'd send top academicians from all over the world to go every 2 weeks. And then it was once a quarter and so on and so forth. So we finished it in 5 years and now they're on their own and they let us know once in a while of how they're doing and if they have any questions that they can actually, it's not a Zoom, they have a different system and say, we're in the OR, we don't know what this is, can you help us? And we would always be available to actually look at it and figure out what they need to do. Then, yes.
Is this being expanded to other parts of Africa as well? Oh, yes.
Right. And so then we were able to get the second country, which is in Nepal. And so this is their second year. And this COVID is a big impact because we can't send people. Mm-hmm. And probably in 3 years, we'll be looking for the third country. So now we actually screen them, which we didn't know how to do. And, you know, it's a long story, but the point is that women wait for not just months or years, but they wait for decades to have this fixed. And women who have fistulas are really not part of the community because of the smell. So I remember the first time you can, I think there's a picture, but anyway, it's the first time when I started and we walked in to the hospital that outside there were probably 500 women who are waiting. And so I said, why are they outside the hospital, not inside the hospital? And they said, oh, because they smell. So they're not allowed to go into the hospital until that they're ready for surgery. And so these women would wait outside for weeks and months for us to come because they don't really know when we're coming and they don't want to miss the opportunity. And so when we can only do 100 or so, then there, you know, the other few hundreds are left behind. And you'd have to obviously promise them they will be back. Otherwise, it's really tragic when we are leaving and there are women who are left behind not knowing whether it's ever going to be fixed. And these are women who have had so many different pregnancies with dead babies and they are ostracized by the society. And they don't have a husband and they live in a hut far away from the community. And if they have a mom or someone who really cares about them, they would get a meal or two a day. And they die early for many different reasons. And this happens at the age of 14, 16, and they feel that this is really their fault. It is God's will that they are meant to live this way. So they blame themselves. So even after that, this is repaired, there's a lot of psychological issues that we have to address. So I was part of different organizations, including Operation Smile, and led the team of 50 to do this. And when they realized the extensive nature in how to really address this issue, that they decided that this is not something they can pursue.
I think this is so remarkable, right? It talks to humanity, it talks to understanding the problems, and then it talks to using technology, using your gifts as an educator to allow these countries to then take care of their own people. And I think the book Cutting for Stone by Verghese was about this. And I think our viewers can go to fiuga.org, which is your association's website, to learn more about this and to see what they can do. You know, switching back to Girma, we think about humanitarian work as only being overseas, but in fact, Operation Giving Back, which you're the medical director of for the American College of Surgeons, has projects that are taking place within the United States. And there's one in particular I read about at an Indian health hospital in Arizona. Could you talk about that a bit for us?
Yeah. So my role as a medical director is really to promote volunteerism everywhere, so including in our backyards. And I think you raised an important point about the fact that we actually forget our backyard. Think about our inner cities. Think about the places in the Indian reservations, and also just think about even on the island of Puerto Rico, since the Hurricane Maria, for example, that are devastated. So the opportunities for surgeons to volunteer within here, within the U.S., is absolutely enormous. And we can help actually connect surgeons to places and sites within the U.S. within the geographic area where they live, so that they can actually provide important service. The Indian services or the Puerto Rican services that surgeons provide for free are surgeons that use actually their free time and volunteer time to go in those places and provide provide basically the much needed help. And as you know, the surgeons who enroll in the Indian services actually are employed to some degree by the government. And it has it is definitely a lot of sacrifices they go through, be it economical and others, to provide the much needed help in those areas. And if you look at the service we provided over the past 2 years in Puerto Rico in conjunction with Hurricane Maria, Inc., which is an NGO, we had two surgeons from the mainland, if you will, that would go every week to provide service at the hospital that was provided by the Secretary of Health of Puerto Rico for free. And so there is indeed a lot of goodwill from surgeons to work within the U.S., but abroad, the need is enormous. The need is enormous. This is a picture from Puerto Rico with the Hurricane Maria Inc. leader and our local surgeon just going for a site visit. And the need is enormous in the globe. There's 5 billion people who don't even have just a basic surgical needs. You know, people die from abscesses, from appendicitis, or are disabled because there is a fracture and it's a farmer that can. So 5 billion people have no access. So I think our responsibility as surgeons to heal and cure is really, really enormous. And I hope people will join us.
We have a comment from a viewer on LinkedIn saying, hearing all of you is so inspiring in your ability and your genius to heal humankind, but it's your compassion. It's that dedication. It's taking 2 weeks out of your lives to go do something. I have contributed a little bit, and I have to tell you, there is nothing more challenging and fulfilling than doing these humanitarian trips. Before COVID, I would go to Nicaragua with a group called Mayflower Medical Outreach, and where we offer ear, nose, and throat and OBGYN care, and we've sponsored a residential school for the deaf, and as both of you have talked about, teaching fishing, right? We have trained many surgeons, many audiologists, many audio techs, many teachers of the deaf. And, you know, it's also an opportunity to just find the joy in healthcare again. The child on my lap over there, had a middle ear problem that would have left him in a school for the deaf as opposed to mainstreamed. And I operated on both ears in the same trip, which is something we wouldn't do here, but the opportunity isn't there. And he got mainstreamed into a regular school and I got a hug out of it. And then the tall trees next to me in one of those pictures are my oldest son and one of my nephews who came with me in their final year of high school. And they worked with the children at the School of the Deaf and they painted the school. So there's so much that we can offer. And I think it's really amazing that it's something we didn't think about when we went into medical school, something we could give back.
Yeah, it really is. I want to thank you both for joining us and Suju as well. You know, it's great, the humanitarian work. I just work at home. So it is a goal, actually, at some point now that I'm an empty nester, that maybe I can actually do that or get my kids to come on one of these trips instead of doing a vacation with them. That would be even better. I want to thank you again. We do have to thank our producers who help with the show and our executive producer who's not here today, but these are the crew behind us and behind the show that really make it happen and make it flow so well. And I want to thank all of them. We're also grateful to WBAI 99.5 FM. And WBAI.org, they carry our show on Mondays from 2 to 3. So this, if you guys are driving or on the internet, you can actually listen to the show again. Certainly, it's also going to be playing on, it's stored on YouTube and Twitter and LinkedIn. So you can find us there as well.
So we want to thank very much our guests for this week. Dr. Guillermo Tefera, who is Chief of Vascular Surgery at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and Medical Director of Operation Giving Back at the American College of Surgeons, and raised by a single mother with 6 siblings, which I didn't know until 30 minutes ago. And we want to thank Dr. Sue Kwan, who is the Chief of Urogynecology at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City, which is part of Northwell Health, and Vice President of the Foundation for International Urogynecological Assistance. I think we could have kept talking, and I'm sorry that the hour is up, but thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your insights. Next week, we will have 2 more wonderful guests, one of whom will be Dr. Camille Clare, who is an obstetrician gynecologist at Metropolitan Hospital in New York City and the head of diversity and inclusion at New York Medical College. And we wanted to close with another little remembrance of a woman who made this possible for us, Marina.
Yeah, she totally really paved the way, leader, icon, notorious. So this is our last slide, which just has some beautiful images of her.
Thank you all for watching, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.